Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself and see if these things be true.
We are back, folks. Happy Tuesday. This is the Torah Teachers Roundtable Show, the Tanakh edition specifically, where we talk about some of those other elements, and in this case, books in Scripture that don't get quite as much coverage because they're not part of the regular cycle, either the Torah cycle or the Haftarah that goes with it. And where we are now is towards the end of chapter 40 of the book of Ezekiel. I'm assuming we'll finish that up here forthwith, but what we need to do is go to MP first, say howdy, because he didn't quite get as far as he wanted to last week, and we'll start with him. So good afternoon, Mark. How you doing?
Well, good afternoon to you, too, and all you people out there in radio land. And you, too, Ken. I got held up at verse 27, so I'd like to get started around verse 28. Would you care to read that? 28 to 31 or 34.
Okay. Yeah, I thought we already have, but we'll go ahead and do it again.
Well,
since we
probably
got people
have, but it can't hurt to.
Yeah. So then it says, this is the prophet speaking. He brought me to the inner court through the southern gateway. He measured the southern gateway according to these same measurements. So what we're seeing here is a lot of measurements being made of a temple that I will suggest clearly has not yet been built. Also, its gate chambers, its gate posts, and its archways were according to these same measurements. In other words, they were similar to the ones we've already seen. There were windows in it, and its archways all around. It was 50 cubits long, 25 cubits wide. There were archways all around, 25 cubits long, 5 cubits wide. Its archways faced the outer court. Palm trees were on its gate posts. Going up it were 8 steps. And he brought me into the inner court facing east. He measured the gateway according to these same measurements. So, in other words, it's the same size. Also, its gate chambers, its gate posts, and its archways according to these same measurements. And there were windows in it and in its archways all around. It, too, was 50 cubits long and 25 cubits wide. Its archways faced the outer court. Palm trees were on its gate posts on this side and on the other side. In other words, on both sides. And going up it were, again, 8 steps. Let's pause there. Is that good enough, Mark?
That's good. Yep. Here I got 28 to 31. If you guys have not gotten past there, I'll stop and let you go. Anyway, 28 to 31, the messenger took Zeke to the inner court adjacent to the south gate. The Zamra has this on that, on verse 28 to 37. They say, describe the plan, the verses 28 to 37, describe the plan of the inner courtyard and with its 3 gates facing those of the outer courtyard. Now, the outer court is like a common area just inside the gates to the world at large, but not in the inner court where the Kohen offers the daily offerings, presumably from the southern side of the altar where the ramp was. I assume, therefore, that the altar of burnt offering was raised to about the level of the outer court and the entrance to the Kodesh Kodeshim. The floor of the inner court was likely a few feet below the level of the holy, most holy, and the altar was as likely on the same level as the floor of the Kodesh Kodeshim. I am giving my impression, not gospel fact, because I was never there physically. Treasury of Scripture Knowledge has this note on verse 29. They say, the entrance to the inner court seems to have been through a portico, exactly like that of each gate to the of the outer court, but the ascent was by 8 steps instead of 7, as in verses 7, 10, and 12. They went up 7 steps. This one, they went up 8. In E.W. Bullinger's number in Scripture, 7 equals fullness or completion, and 8 equals new beginnings. Therefore, I think that the extra step points to the new creation. Second Corinthians 5:17 says, therefore, if any man be in Mashiach, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. I could be wrong, but I seriously doubt it. Verses 32 to 34, I know we've read through there. Now Yah is taking Zeke to the eastern inner court. This is the side that faces the Mount of Olives, and that to which the entire entourage of priests bowed to the sun in chapter 8 and verse 16. And he brought me into the inner court of Yah's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of Yah, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 and 20 men with their backs toward the temple of Yah and their faces toward the east, and they worshiped the sun in the east. I will not comment on that particular history because it'll just tick MC off. And besides, we're looking at the new creation's temple, not the one defiled by those so-called priests of Yah. Please notice once again that the approach has eight steps, which number alludes to new beginnings and a new creation. That's why I think that this is the new creation's temple. This court has exactly the same description as the last, except for the side of the temple on which it is located. And once again, the description alludes to the same new beginnings as the previously mentioned inner court. Now, verses 35 to 37, I'll finish with this. Yah brought Zeke to the northern gate, and it was of the same measurements as all the others. There is an intended symmetry in Yah's temple. He is consistent in his actions and in his expectations for all of us, which is one of the meanings of perfect in his generations. Everything he does is perfect to every detail, and he will never in any way deny himself. Here he measures the northern gate, and what to our wondering eyes should appear but exactly the same measurements as the other gates. Go figure. And the number of steps is, once again, 8, another new beginning. That's what I got through verse 37. If you'd like to, if anyone would like to question or comment, I'd be happy to give it up.
Okay. Well, that would be, let's see if Ken does.
Yeah, there aren't too many folks here that can speak up, huh? I just happen to be one of them. Hey! one thing I heard MP say was something about the word common. The only thing I would think a little bit differently there is that I believe the outer wall to me would be the major separator between those drawing near unto Yah and everything else being outside that outer wall. So to me, that would be the common space would be outside the outer wall. I believe maybe the fact that they're walking up 7 steps to begin with to get into the outer court might be a working towards that end time event, possibly for up until the Shabbat millennium, let's say. You know, maybe it sort of signifies that period of time and those people who, you know, have reached a certain point, et cetera, et cetera. But that's about the only difference I would say between what MP had said and what I would consider common anyway. One thing I noticed was this word arches, which is the word elam or Elema in the Hebrew. That's Strong's number 361. It's mentioned 14 times in all of Scripture, this word arches, and solely in Ezekiel chapter 40. You will only find these arches as well when you find each instance of it in the vicinity of a gate. And thus, I believe the two, you know, the arch and the gate, are very closely related. They're certainly related in terms of distance. I mean, they're, I believe they're sort of up against each other or next to each other. So wherever you see a gate, you're probably going to have an arch. Now, in terms of these openings, okay, what I'm finding regarding wall openings, and I'm talking about the area where, you know, where we're allowing someone to pass through the wall, whether it be the external wall or the internal wall, that there are three passages within each wall. There's a north, an east, and a south passage. And each passage, from what I can read, what I'm understanding, is that each passage has a gate on either side of it. Okay? So a gate on the external side and a gate on the internal side. And that is a pretty big, area. And, I mean, when you're looking at the cubit sizes. So thus, to reach the inner court, for example, from the outer court, when to the east of the altar, one would walk through the inner wall passage, which, consists of two east gates. It would be an inner and an outer. And of course, palm trees are found on the posts of either side of the gate as one walks up to the gate. And I think I may have mentioned a little bit about that last week, that is I believe, related as well with the cherubim or cherubim, in that the two are often together, and we're going to see that here as well. But still, it is definitely for our eyes to see. And that, you know, to me, this each gate in itself has to do with judgment. So I believe each gate that we pass through, you know, we've apparently reached a verdict, a certain point of agreement with Yah, in that, you know, we have reached a certain point, and thus we can make it through a certain gate. And maybe some folks who are, you know, super blessed, walking perfectly in Yah, they're most likely going to be walking or being able to walk through all the gates from the outer wall through to the inner wall, and then eventually even through the doors as well, as in the doors to the tabernacle. So, but every time you come upon such a physical device, whether it's a gate or a door, you know, there is normally either palm trees and or cherubim that we will see. So there is most certainly, I would say, levels of judgment, you know. I believe, and this is very similar to how the tabernacle was built even in the days of Moshe or Moses. You know, there, certain people could only go to certain points, you know, certain places, sometimes up to the altar only. Others do work inside the holy place, you know. Others are able to, such as the Levites, they do service at the altar and other places. So, you know, each wherever people are, you know, it often is related to where they stand in terms of judgment. And remember that this doesn't really have to be a physical tabernacle. This, because it is a vision, it could be a picture of something physical, but to show us something, you know, spiritual. And of course, even, you know, Shaul or Paul in the Brit Hadashah or New Testament tells us that we are such a tabernacle. You know, we can also fall into that category. and also, I've always thought of that final tabernacle to be one where Mashiach is the cornerstone, and we are all of the remaining stones, so that we together make that tabernacle that allows Yah to dwell in us, you know, his light And we're going to see that, his light as well in future verses. So that's what I have up to verse 37.
Okay. Well, do we have anything else, MP? Are you ready to move on?
Oh, yeah, we can move on. 38 to 43 at least.
Okay, I did. And so we're still talking about the measurement, the archways, and the entrances. Then it says, he brought me to the north gateway and measured it according to these same measurements. So there's a symmetry here. Also, its gate chambers, its gate posts, and its archways had windows all around. Its length was 50 cubits and its width 25 cubits. Its gate posts faced the outer court. Palm trees were on the gate posts on either side, on this side and on that side. And going up to it, as MP has pointed out, were eight steps. Then verse 38 continues, saying, a chamber and its entrance, or the King James adds, there was a chamber and its entrance by the gateposts of the gateway, where they washed the burnt offering. In the vestibule of the gateway were two tables on this side, two tables on that side, on which to slay the burnt offering, the chatat, the sin offering, and the trespass offering. At the outer side of the vestibule, on as one goes up to the entrance of the northern gateway, were two tables. And on the other side of the vestibule, well, also two tables. Four tables were on this side and four tables on that side by the side of the gateway, eight tables on which they slaughtered, that's basically where the Hebrew ends. Eight tables on which they slaughtered, and the King James feels the need to add the sacrifices. Now remember, there's other things. There are offerings, and they're not all offerings are sacrifices. There right. were also four tables of hewn stone for the burnt offering, 1.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1 cubit high. And on these they laid the instruments with which they slaughtered the olah, the burnt offering, and the sacrifice. Inside were hooks, hand breadth wide, fastened all around, and the flesh of the sacrifices on the tables. Okay, let's pause there. This time we'll go to Ken first.
Sure. So, yeah, I'll just say a few words on 38 through 43 here. Chambers near the posts is where they would apparently wash the olah offering, which I really couldn't remember the washing of that sacrifice, but that makes it very, very special, most definitely. Remember, olah is the whole burnt offering. So from how I read it, there are eight tables in total on the north gate of the inner wall. And it appears four are on one side and four are on the other side. Now, I believe that might even be on either side of the passage, meaning, you know, four on the, literally on the outer court side and four on the inner court side. But I could be wrong. It could be the way that it's written. It, you know, I'm sure we'll hear some different opinions here, but these tables, it definitely talks about the specifics of the slaying of the olah or the whole burnt offering, the chata or sin offering, and the asham trespass offerings. And those three are certainly very important. And because of the listing of these three, we should now know for sure this is not in the eternal, but either before or during the Sabbath millennium. Now, to me, I believe this is all after the previous chapters. I believe this may even be a little bit of a timeline going on here, speaking of the tabernacle right after what happened with Yisrael, Yisrael being changed in the last few chapters. To me, this could be at that point, you know, once people are changed at the Sabbath millennium. So that's how I feel about what's going on here. I believe this may very well be the beginning of the Sabbath millennium. So anyway, that's what I have up to verse 43. So I'll pass the mic.
All right.
Okay. Well, let me do this. Just ask a question. And certainly one of the things that has been quite divisive, you'll hear all of this, is and they will reference, and I will suggest that there are several problems with the language, but they'll say, Jesus was the last sacrifice, the final sacrifice, the only sacrifice. And there are a whole lot of problems with that because, again, there's a different word for sacrifices and for offerings. We certainly know that the same guy that they credit with writing, or at least some do, the thing that says he was the only, the last, the final, there wouldn't be any more. We know, according to Acts chapter, it's mentioned a couple places, but Paul was told, hey, there's a rumor about you. You better do this to make sure that people understand that, no, it's not true. So he took a Nazirite vow. There are offerings that are made at the end of the Nazirite vow.
Yep.
He made those offerings. As a matter of fact, he paid for other people to have those offerings too. So there are all kinds of problems, in other words, with various doctrines here. What I'm going to ask is the following. There look like there are going to be sacrifices made in this temple too. And that would seem to be problematic if one believes that it's all done away with and it's never going to happen anymore. And let's go to you as MP first.
That's mostly because when Paul was in his ministry, he also submitted to the rabbis in Jerusalem, okay? Because he was a rabbi, and he, in order for him to not have controversy out where he was preaching Yeshua, okay, as the fulfillment of all this stuff, he had to knuckle under. Just like anybody else does. If, you know, I may not like to do 65 mile an hour on the freeway. I might like to do 75 or 80. But you know what? There's people out there to keep me doing 65. It's going to be the same thing in any kind of hierarchical society. And all societies are hierarchical in one way or another. In the case of the Jews, there was a very strict hierarchy, and the priests were at the top, okay, and the rabbis were next, and then there was all those people, you know. Kepha in chapter 10 of Acts, he sees the sheet coming.
Either.
I'm sorry, say that again.
I was going to say that eventually there were no priests, at least no legitimate priests as well. We don't want to forget that.
Oh, absolutely. That absolutely did happen too. But in the meanwhile, Kepha saw the tablecloth, if you will, you know, full of all different kinds of beasts, clean and unclean and all that. And the voice from heaven saying, Kepha, kill and eat. And he said, I've never eaten anything that was common or unclean. Okay? And the thing is taken away, and then it comes again. Kepha, kill and eat. He says, I've never eaten anything as common or unclean. And then Yah says, what I have made clean, don't you call it common. Okay? What I have made clean. He made clean animals. They do not become defiled by touching unclean animals. And that was the rabbinic tradition. And that was what cured Kepha of that kind of garbage. Okay? He said, oh. And then when he finishes the thing, he saw the thing three times, and when his vision is over, the first thing he hears is, and I did that purposely, knock, knock, knock. Okay? Three guys at the door waiting for him from the centurion. What the heck was the guy's name? I can't remember now. Anyway, from the centurion up north. And he sent three Jews down to get him to teach, to come and tell him about the gospel. Okay? And Kepha says, wow, this guy wants to become a part of Israel. Okay? He wants to become a part of Israel. I can't not go to him.
Okay, well, MP, we can't not go to break right now. So we'll pick it up there after the bottom of the hour.
Don't take me soon, because I am here. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more, there'll be no more war, and
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keeping Torah's a joy to do.
We are back, folks. This is the second half now of the first hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition. We are almost finished with Chapter 40, which has to do with a new temple that's being described here in no short amount of detail, along with some other, I guess you'd say, problematic questions, at least when it comes to some of the dogma that many of us have heard in Sun God Day School. And that's part of the reason why I think it's important to go through this and ask ourselves, so, gee, what about this is consistent with Scripture and what isn't? So when we went to break, MP was getting ready to make a comment, I think, that would at least address that. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah. I was relating the story of Kepha and all that, but and I think I got the point across. He realized through that vision that just because an unclean animal touched a clean animal, the clean animal was not made unclean or defiled in any way. Okay, that's what that vision was given to him for.
Well, wait a minute.
And then
I thought maybe that vision was given. This is what I was told anyway. That vision was given to say, the heck with the Torah. You can have all the pork you want now. Let's hang around for the potluck afterwards. Get yourself a ham sandwich.
No.
No? Oh, man.
No. That's not true at all.
Wow. Who could have thought it?
No.
You mean they lied. Okay.
Well, They lied. Absolutely. That's exactly it.
We joke about it a little
as
bit.
As he comes out of the vision, he hears the knock on the door, and there's three guys there saying, we'd like you to come and talk to this guy. He says, not only can you come in my house, okay, where I'm staying, all right, we'll go there tomorrow. And these were I'm guessing that they were Jewish converts to Messiah, okay? But in the meanwhile, he saw the thing let down, and there's unclean animals and clean animals, and they come down in this thing. They were all touching each other, and just because they touched each other did not make the clean unclean, okay? That's how it goes, and that's how it goes with us. We just touching somebody who's not a believer does not make us unclean. Okay, we are not defiled in any way by touching an unclean person or a person who is a non-believer. Okay, so that's the story there. And Peter said, great, you guys come in. I'm going to feed you. And tomorrow we'll take off and we'll go see this guy. And they preach the gospel in that place. And literally hundreds of people were converted to Yeshua and to Biblical Judaism. Okay? So it's just as amazing to me how people can screw things like that up. Anyway, let me get back to Azamra, our text here. To verses 38 to 43. Azamra has this, it's real quick. They say the verses 38 to 43 describe the washer's chamber where the sacrificial portions will be washed and prepared for offering on the altar. Okay, that's the end of my Azamra comment. But here's what I have to say about that. The entry to the four rooms dedicated to washing the animals to be... I'm sorry, say again?
Nope. Don't think anybody said anything.
Oh, okay. I heard something come out of the mic. Anyway, or out of the speaker. The entry to the four rooms dedicated to washing the animals to be offered faced away from the altar of burnt offering. Only the very corners of those rooms that were adjacent to the altar of burnt offering had any entry or access to the inside of the courtyard where the offerings were actually made. I have to think that these chambers had these narrow apertures to keep as much of the scent of the burnt offering from frightening the animal that was being prepared for its offering to Yah for us. For some reason, this brought Kepha's vision of Acts 10 to mind. The sheet let down from heaven, and I got it all down here. By its four corners and all manner of clean and unclean animals bunched in the center of the sheet, touching each other, which the rabbis say made every clean animal on that sheet common, not unclean, but defiled. And Yah's disabusing Kepha of the falseness of that rabbinic silliness so that he could go with the three guys to hear a knock, knock, knock. Did you see what I did there? Knock, knock, knock. Three guys. Okay, got all this stuff. On his host's door to Caesarea and Cornelius's house. The rabbinic halakha was wrong. The unclean animals did not make the clean animals common, no matter how many times they touched. The clean cannot be defiled by a mere touch from a common or unclean creature. You, who are clean, petting your dog does not make you common. You can eat clean food with a goy. You eating clean food with a goy does not make you common or anything else but clean. Until such time as you actually transgress and take yourself into yourself unclean food. Bacon or pork? No. Beef or lamb? Go for it. That animal, that clean animal, can wrestle with your dog and neither animal is changed. Nothing but biblically clean animals were killed, cleaned, and slaughtered on those tables in those chambers. The rabbinic halakha is more stringent than Yah's word. And that's the problem that I got with Orthodox Judaism. They know the scripture. They know it backward and forward, but they don't get it because they've never bothered to read Acts chapter 10. Anyway. That's what I got through verse 43.
Okay. Ken, you want to comment?
I'd like to comment on what Mark is getting across here in Acts 10, because I've always understood it differently from what MP understands it. I've always understood it that, firstly, Peter was confused. He did not understand what he saw at first.
Exactly.
Well, he says,
and
so.
I think it took him a while. I'm sorry?
He says so.
I say exactly. That's why the vision.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
MC said he says what?
He said he didn't understand it. He asked for clarification. And then later, in case people didn't get it, he tells us what it was that he was made to understand, which is why, you know, there shouldn't be any doubt about the fact that it didn't have to do with food.
Right. Exactly.
Exactly.
And it actually brings you down to verse 28 in Acts 10 where it was written, and he said unto them, you know how that it is an unlawful thing for a man that is a Jew to keep company or come unto one of another nation.
That's
so
right.
Firstly, yes, definitely the Jews were not accustomed to sitting or being amongst people outside the camp, so to speak, right?
Okay, still aren't.
Yeah, those from outside.
Let me just quickly, before we move too far, add one other thing there. Because you read a word that really rankles me in a lot of translations. It is unlawful. Well, no, it's your blankety-blanket traditions. It's the traditions of men that say that it's, and it's their nomos, okay? There may be a Greek word that is conflated, but it is not anti-Torah, and that is the real key. That's what 99% of, pardon my bluntness, the whore church misses. They don't get it. It's not unlawful. It's just what they claim you're not supposed to do because it's their halaha, but let's not confuse it with the written Torah of Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. And again, that's one of those things that I think is really important and extremely overlooked, and probably on purpose.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I totally agree. And what also then mean, like MP was saying, is that they were literally teaching this to other Jews as Jews grew up and you know, were educated in the Torah and other written words, such as, let's say, the Talmud.
And the reason, by the way, guys, the reason, and we've talked about this before, but this emphasizes it, the reason is because they are taught exactly what Catholicism teaches. We make the rules. We will add to and subtract from. Exactly. If we write the law, it's the law. Yeshua said, hey, right. You know, they bind burdens on men, and he made all kinds of things, called them hypocrites, because you'd think they would know you're not supposed to add to or subtract from. But the whore church did the same thing. They said, hey, we're going to change things. Pork is fine, but not fish, unless it's, fish on Fridays is the only requirement. So they added to and subtracted from. So did the rabbis, and both of them had a problem with the real Yeshua for that very reason, because he told them they were hypocrites.
Exactly.
Yes, agreed. excuse me. So, yeah, those Jews, especially even up until today, have been claiming that one must use the Talmud in order to understand the Torah.
Get out of here.
So, and there it is right there. This unlawful thing is what their idea is of Torah. It's kind of like their own Torah. They made up their own Torah and they called it the Talmud, you know?
Yep.
So it wasn't, it really wasn't his Torah that was being unlawful here. It was their own making of all this stuff.
And in that sense, they're absolutely
Yah had
no
to
difference.
Set them straight.
They're no different on that score than the Roman Catholics, who will essentially say, you can't read, you layperson, you can't read the Bible for yourself. Don't even try. You have to have a priest interpret it for you. Unless people think that that's right. Old doctrine, it was reaffirmed by Pope Satan within the last year. You got to have a priest or you'll get it wrong. Don't trust, you know, who
Absolutely.
You going to trust, us or your lying eyes?
That's right. That's right. But then we see at the end of this verse that I'm trying to get to, it says, well, I should not call any man common or unclean.
That's
no.
It.
Can you imagine that? He's actually saying that Yah is the one who judges a man, not you. It's like, oh, where is that cleanness? You know, what is clean? It's actually on the inside. It's not the outside, which is what they were all focused on, you know, what they look like, what they wear, their clothing, you know, how they're common, you know, in terms of looks and what they appear like. I mean, appearances were everything back in those days. But no, Yah is the one that judges. Yah is the one who cleans in, you know, and that's why it makes sense that we always love one another from the get-go until we find out otherwise, not the other way around. You know,
exactly.
Be separate from one another until you realize, oh, they're actually one of us.
Yep.
You know what I mean? They're cursing everything. Anyway, I just want to put in that 2 cents, but I think I was ready to take it on to Verse 49.
Okay, MP, are you ready or not?
Go ahead.
Okay.
All right. So, let's take a run at it. I got to about verse 45 or so. So then he said to me, this chamber which faces south is for the Kohanim, the priests, who have charge of the temple. The chamber which faces north is for the priests who have charge of the altar. Those are the sons of Zadok from the sons of Levi who come near Yahuwah to minister unto him. Remember, we had a change in the lineage there. There were some, help my memory here. Forget who was king at the time, but essentially the priests of Zadok were Torah obedient and others weren't, and so there was you guys are out of here and priests of Zadok are the new line that matters among those sons of Aaron. So feel free to chime in if somebody remembers what I'm not there, time wise. I'll take the silence to mean not, all right. Anyway, then it says he measured the court. Is that a comment, MP?
No, there's no comment. Go ahead.
Okay, so he measured the court. 100 cubits long and 100 cubits wide. In other words, it was square, four square. The altar was in front of the temple. Then he brought me to the vestibule of the temple and measured the doorposts of that vestibule. 5 cubits on this side, 5 cubits on that side. And the width of the gateway was 3 cubits on this side and 3 cubits on that side. The length of the vestibule, 20 cubits. And the width, 11 cubits. And by the steps which led up to it, there were pillars by the doorpost, one on this side and another on that side. So we've got, that's the final verse in terms of the description here of this new temple. Ken, let's go back to you, I think.
Ken or me?
Ken is what I said, unless you're going to want, I don't care. Well, if you really want to go, you can.
I'll be brief here. So we see that the Levite priesthood was in the chambers to the south of the house, and their duty was keeping charge of the house. Whereas the Zadokite priesthood was in the chambers to the north of the house, and their duty was keeping the charge of the altar. Now, you know, to me, this is pretty much like it was in the days of Moshe. Remember, you had the Levites who their duty was to literally manage the operations of the tabernacle. That means keeping charge of the house, just like it is here. But there was a small group that was pretty much above them, which was the Aaronic priesthood, which were Levites, but they were from a certain
they were through Aaron, yeah.
Group, internal grouping, right? And they were mediators, right, between man and Yah. They were to be, you know, the high priesthood. The high priest is a mediator, and that has to do with between, you know, helping with the either communications, the efforts between each individual and Yah himself. In other words, normally the individual would come to the altar with their gift, right? With their animal, right? They would come and then they would of course slaughter it there. They would put their hand on it. It's kind of the idea of prayer. You know, and then they would hand it over.
Honestly.
And then that.
Briefly, I've always thought, having raised animals, it's especially poignant now today, that part of the reason why sometimes it's the priest, sometimes it's the person who brings, usually it's the person who brings it, sometimes it's on behalf of the priest. But in any case, whoever it is that's doing this puts their hand on this thing which is getting ready to give up its life. And I can't help but think, and I, like I said, it's poignant to me, having raised animals and watched them, to have your hand on this thing's head, which is fixing to die, is it's going to make a real impression. So, yeah, I mean, there's an element of prayer. I'm not going to deny that. But when it comes to a, right. Gee, this is going to make an emotional impact, that is certainly true as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If you're raising the sheep and now you've got to slaughter it and you've been feeding this thing, you've been taking it out to pasture and all that stuff, and that's got to be rough on you, man.
It's
that's
hard.
Got to be really rough on you.
Yeah,
you get attached to your right. animal. You know, it's just so, how it is. And that's so, and that's, you know, basically Yah and us. I mean, really and truly, it's like the difference is probably just about the same. Yah to us and us to our animals.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
So, yeah, anyway, I kind of see this very similar to how it was in the days of Aaron and Moshe in terms of the duties. Because, again, everything that's done at the altar is something coming from all the individuals. You know, or, I mean, after, of course, they begin the process with their own sacrifices and stuff to get things started. But then all the individuals come up, and that's when everything comes to the altar normally. So anyway, and then lastly, I think also I noted verse 47 to me is very clear in saying that the inner court is 100 cubits square. Now, why do I say that? It's because last weekend, I think after I was hearing what was Mark was considering regarding the outer wall being 100 cubits, I really think it's the inner court that's 100 cubits, and the outer is much, much larger. But I'm going to talk about that in the coming chapters. So anyway, that's pretty much all I have to the end of the chapter here.
Okay.
All right. Well, let me get on it here. Zamra has this on verses 44 to 47, one sentence. Verses 44 to 47 describe other special chambers in the inner courtyard for the instruments of the Levites and the garments of the priests. So this was mainly for changes of garments between offerings and getting whatever tool might be needed to properly offer the animals, I think. I could be wrong, but I really do doubt it. I think that's what that's about. Now, Zamra has this on 48 and 49. Verses 48 and 49 describe the measurements of the ulam, or the vestibule, leading into the main temple sanctuary building. The pillars outside, this is me now, the pillars outside the east gate of the temple were made hollow with the hand breadth, that is about 4 inches thick, of brass and solid brass capitals, okay, is what it would be in King James kind of thing. So here's what it says in 1 Kings 7:14 through 22, reading from the KJV. He, that is Hiram of Tyre, was a widow's son of the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in brass. And he was filled with wisdom and understanding and cunning to work all works in brass. And he came to King Shlomo and wrought all his work. And he cast 2 pillars of brass of 8 cubits high apiece and a line of 12 cubits, roughly 18 to 20 feet, okay, around, did compass either of them about. And he made 2 chapiters of molten brass. This is capitals of the pillar, okay, the upper portion of it, okay, and to set upon the tops of the pillars. The height of the 1 chapiter was 5 cubits, and the height of the other chapiter was 5 cubits. The nets of checker work and wreaths of chain work for the chapiters, which were upon the top of the pillars, 7 for the 1 chapiter and 7 for the other. And he made the pillars and 2 rows round about upon the 1 network to cover the chapiters that were upon the top with pomegranates. And so did he with the other chapiter. And the chapiters that were upon the top of the pillars were of lily work in the porch, 4 cubits. And the chapiters upon the 2 pillars had pomegranates also above, over against the belly, which was by the network. And the pomegranates were 200 in rows round about upon the other chapiter. And he set up the pillars on the porch of the temple, and he set up the right pillar and called the name.
Okay, we are at the break. We'll finish that up when we get back.
And I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for reasons. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will be one way. Sometimes I lay under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Petron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself to see if these things be true.
I know someday,
Let's see. I had a problem with my Skype window. That's no surprise. But I think it was MP that said he wanted to go ahead. Is that correct? Anyway, we are back. And if that was, then go ahead. If I'm wrong, because I can't see the Skype screen, then whoever it was, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, it was me. Okay. Azamra has this on verses 44 to 47. I'm going to finish the chapter here, I think. Verses 44 to 47 describe the other special chambers in the inner courtyard for the instruments of the Levites and the garments of the priests. So this was mainly for changes of garments between offerings and getting whatever tool might be needed to properly offer the animals. I think. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Azamra has this on 48 and 49. Verses 48-49 describe the measurements of the ulam, or vestibule, leading into the main temple sanctuary building. The pillars outside the east gate of the temple were made hollow with a hand thick of brass and solid brass chapiters. Now, I read that already, I understand, but this passage of 1 Kings is important for us to understand. Okay, now Hiram of Tyre was a widow's son of the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in brass, and he was filled with wisdom and understanding and cunning in the work, all works of brass. And he came to King Shlomo and wrought all his work, and he cast two pillars of brass of 18 cubits high apiece, a line of 20 cubits, roughly 18 to 20 feet around, did compass either of them about. And he made two chapiters of molten brass. Now, that means capitals is what we call it. So set upon the tops of the pillars. The height of the one chapiter was 5 cubits. The height of the other was 5 cubits. The nets of checker wood, the wreaths in, of chain work for the chapiters that were upon the top of the pillars, 7 and for one chapiter and 7 for the other chapiter. And he made the pillars and 2 rows round about upon the one network to cover the chapiters that were on the top with pomegranates. And so did he for the other chapiter. And the chapiters that were upon the top of the pillars were of lily work in the porch, 4 cubits. And the chapiters upon the 2 pillars had pomegranates also above, over against the belly with which by the network, was by the network. And the pomegranates were 200 in rows round about upon the other chapiter. And he set up the pillars and in the porch and the temple, and he set up the right pillar and called the name of it Yachin, and he set up the left pillar and called it Boaz, and upon the top of the pillars was lily work. So was the work of the pillars finished. Now these chapiters, this is me talking now, were the tops of the brass pillars that stood outside the eastern gate to the temple. I think these were called the capitals in our days. Okay. Now, there is a very interesting discrepancy between the 1 Kings 7 passage quoted here and the 2 Kings 25, 16, and 17 passage where it says this. The 2 pillars, 1C, and the bases which Shlomo had made for the house of Yah, the brass of all of these vessels were without weight. The weight of the 1 pillar was 18 cubits, and the chapiter upon it was brass, and the height of that chapiter was 3 cubits. What did it say before? They were 7 cubits, okay? And the wreath and the pomegranates upon the chapiter of all the brass, and like unto these, had the 2 pillar with wreath work. Do you see the discrepancy? When Hiram made the capitals, they were 5 cubits long. But when they were in their places after the siege, they were apparently only 3 cubits long. Where did the 2 cubits, about 40 to 45 inches of solid brass, disappear to? Simple answer is, the sand had been let out of the pillars. Boaz and Yachin had slipped inside the hollow pillars because the sand holding them up had been used for its intended purpose. the invaders found no furnishings at all in the house of Yah. Yirmiyahu, Zeke's dad, had spirited them away to a secret hiding place, I think, in Moshe's place of meeting with Yah all those centuries before on or in Mount Sinai.
Okay.
Okay. What happened was that these hollow pillars were used to work the sand hydraulic elevators inside the temple. And they let the sand out of one, and it raised up lowered down the floor of the Holy of Holies. They took all of the important stuff out. They let the sand out of the other one, and it raised the thing back up, and no one would be the wiser. Okay? But all of the important stuff, all the gold it was all gone from the temple. They took it into the Holy of Holies. They lowered the floor. They raised the floor back up again when it was empty, and Jeremiah took that stuff from Sinai and hid it. It's still there.
Okay.
Anyway, I think that's really cool.
But what's the connection to what we're talking about? That's where I'm curious.
Oh. It's part of the building of this temple, of this Holy of Holies. Okay, in the end, that stuff was there specifically so that they could get away with all of the temple furnishings and hide them away.
Right.
And we don't know that from this particular passage that we've read today, but that's and this, by the way, is the future temple anyway. So
yeah, that's
I don't know
what
they'll
understand.
Do with that.
What's the connection? Why did we? What's the connection here? We went through that for.
It's. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. It fascinates me that they thought that far ahead.
But does it have anything to do with the temple we're talking
doing
about?
The same thing with this one. It just fascinates me. That's why I shared that.
Okay. Well, we knew that. All right. What fascinates you, Ken?
We can move on to chapter 41 now if you want.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Chapter 41. It says here, then he brought me into the sanctuary and measured the doorpost. 6 cubits wide on one side, 6 cubits wide on the other side, the width of the tabernacle. The width of the entryway was 10 cubits, and the side walls of the entrance, 5 cubits on this side, 5 cubits on the other side. And he measured the length, 40 on bits. That must be a typo. No, okay, I see what it is. It's a weirdness. It's a typo in the book. 40 cubits. It's on two separate lines in this rendering I'm looking at. And its width. Normally they put a little dash at the end of the line, you know, so that you can tell. Looks like it was 40 some kind of bits. And I'm going,
yeah,
well, if it's a measurement of megabytes. Anyway, 40 cubits. Anyway, also, he went inside and measured the doorpost, 2 cubits, and it's
breaking up.
What? Okay, 6 cubits high, and the width of the entrance, 7 cubits. Let me do one more set of measurements here, then we'll pause. He measured the length, 20 cubits, the width, 20 cubits, beyond the sanctuary, and then he said to me, this is the Kodesh Kodeshim. And, of course, in the English, that's usually rendered most holy place, but it's Kodesh Kodeshim. And we see that a number of places in Scripture. Okay, Ken, we will go to you this time.
Yes.
Okay. Of those four verses, seems like we're getting ready to enter the tabernacle. So we're getting some measurements as we're coming upon it. Is the measurement of 6 being used quite often, even from the beginning of chapter 40. We see this number 6 mentioned time and time and time again. It just feels like more than any other number. And I do recall 6 is often used to a man.
Correct.
And it seems fitting. Yeah, it seems fitting that if this temple is all about us being echad or one with him and being together in this so-called house, then it would make sense that we would be seeing the measurement of six quite often. And it's funny because every time I even see, you know, some of these numbers put together and they're measuring this and measuring that, and I'm remembering that Mashiach is the cornerstone. I can't help but think of us as stones and thinking how each of us be measured differently from another. You know, it's not like we're bricks. We're not conformed to one another. We're not exactly the same. We are likened to unhewn stone, even though he does hewn us.
He's the hewner.
So we allow him. I'm sorry?
Never mind.
Okay.
He's the potter, he's the hewner.
That's right. Yeah, he does it all. So in the end, these measurements may be measurements of each and every one of us, for all we know. So I'm not so sure that it's really important that we understand and are able to take these numbers and go out with AutoCAD and put this building together, and it better be perfect or else we're getting a spanking. Okay. So I wouldn't say study it until you hate math the rest of your life is probably not a good idea. Just, you know, take it in stride in what, you know, really jumps out at you, and try to make thematic connections as much as you can. That's the best I can say for times like this. Okay. So that's all I have through verse 4.
Okay, MP, I'm almost scared, but what fascinates you now?
Well, you ought to be. So anyway, I'm going to open with a Zamra. They have a rather detailed opening comment on this, for lack of a better term right now, esoteric text, because that's what this is. And the Hebrew text of Ezekiel's account of the future temple, which will be the earthly representation of the heavenly temple, is necessarily opaque because it simultaneously is detailed description of the highly complex physical structure and a garb clothing the deepest secrets of God's names and attributes and his government of the world. Now, the classic biblical commentators of our text, Rashi, Netzudas David, Radak, discuss at length the literal meaning of the words and phrases making up Ezekiel's description of the physical structure of the future temple. Hardly enter into Midrash and do not touch at all, at least openly, upon its deeper meaning. The only comprehensive discussion of the latter, with which this author is familiar, and we're talking about Ramchal of Zamra, is that the Kabbalistic genius Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, who side by side with his Mishkanei Elyon on the Kabbalistic meaning of the temple, also provided five chapters in the style of the Mishnah, clarifying its dimensions and physical form on the basis of Ezekiel's text. My dear friend, Rabbi Avraham Rokeach, who is a Talmid Chacham, an authority on the forms of the first, second, and future temples, is also a building engineer by profession, has told me that from the engineering point of view, it is Ramchal's explanation of the physical structure of the future temple that makes the most sense. Within the present, and that's from a guy who is an engineer, a building engineer, okay? That's what he does. Within the scope of the present study notes, it is impossible to do more than briefly categorize the main areas of the temple precincts as described by Ezekiel in these chapters and to offer a tiny sample of comments by Ramchal about the significance of the areas in question, We're going to get a lot of these from me because Azamra is really good about this stuff. Those interested in studying Ezekiel's text in conjunction with Ramchal's commentary in Secrets of the Future Temple should note that Ramchal and in his work takes a different route around the temple from that taken by Ezekiel. For Ezekiel, started at the outer wall of the Temple Mount, entering by the eastern gate into the outer courtyard and then going inwards, first to the inner courtyard and then to the actual temple building itself. Ramchal, on the other hand, chose to discuss first the Holy of Holies and the sanctuary and then move outwards from the temple to the inner courtyard and from there to the outer courtyard and then to the Temple Mount. Verses 1 and 2. The Blue Letter Bible calls this 26-verse chapter the Inner Temple. Stone Stanach calls it the Inner Courtyard, which consists of the recessed into the mountain inner courtyard with access from the outer courtyard by descending steps to the inner courtyard of the north, south, and east sides, as well as west side stairs descending from the Holy of Holies to the inner courtyard. Or all of that vice versa, depending on one's perspective. Now, and that was my addition. Stone Stanach has this comment on verse 1. The main temple building was divided into two parts. The sanctuary, that was 40 cubits long, and the inner sanctum, most holy of holy of holies, or holy of holies, which was 20 cubits long. Besides these was the hall in front of the sanctuary that was 11 cubits long, according to chapter 40 and verse 49. All of these components were 20 cubits wide. The sanctuary was entered into from the hall through a 10-cubit passageway referred to in verse 1 as the tent. Okay, Azamra has this on verses 1 and 2. And he brought me to, and I'll finish with this. And he brought me to the sanctuary, verse 1. The sanctuary is the Heichal, the main temple building. The house itself, containing the showbread table and incense altar, as opposed to its surrounding courtyards. Verses 1 and 2 provide the dimensions of the sanctuary and its entrance. This is the place, as I quote now, this is a place from which the souls of Israel received their sustenance, and this is where the inner incense altar is located. This is the altar where the sacrifices of the souls is offered when they bring their gift before the king, according to Ramchal. Now, in the center and the inner courtyard is the altar of burnt offering, where the on-duty officiating priest would offer the animal that was prepared and slain in one of the chambers, northeast, northwest, southwest, or southeast. There are four chambers surrounding the offering place, which were on the level of the outer courtyard. The map and diagram in Stone's Tanakh seems to have the inner courtyard on a lower level than the northeast, northwest, southwest, and southeast chambers, where the offering animals were slain and prepared for offering on the altar, which was the center of the inner courtyard with a ramp for the officiating priest to approach the altar itself and thereupon to offer the animals for Israel's sins before Yah. And again, I'll be done here in just a second. And again, the officiating priest approached the altar of burnt offering by ascending the ramp from south to north towards the altar. As an aside, do you remember in which direction Abraham and Yitzhak approached Moriah to offer Yitzhak to Yah and where that place was? If you said from the south to Mount Moriah, Genesis 22, 1 through 10, you would be correct. That was not a coinkydink. Okay? They did this purposely because their father Abraham brought Isaac from the south to the north to Mount Moriah to where the temple was sat. Okay? And they were doing exactly what their father Abraham had done. That's what I got through verse 2.
Okay. Go ahead, Ken.
I commented through verse 4.
Oh, you did. Well, then yeah. I'll take another a couple of minutes here. Just get through four.
Okay.
Zamra opens with this on verses 3 and 4. Verses 3 and 4 provide the dimensions of the Holy of Holies, the innermost chamber of the house. The first place that emanated from the foundation stone is a place of intense light and abundant blessing. For as she, that is the Malchut, the kingdom, goes forth from before the king, there she stands immersed in all her beauty and glory. Who can describe her power and brilliance? The power is given only to Israel. A great screen separates the sanctuary from the Holy of Holies. This hall is thus for the king alone and none other. Only once each year on Yom Kippur, when the high priest in the lower world enters the Holy of Holies with the incense, is permission to enter granted to the one who is permitted to enter. This is because God's great love for his people, who are more precious to him than the ministering angels. That all according to Ramchal. Now, in verses 3 and 4 are describing, in my words now, the doors of the Kadoshiest place, the Kodesh Kadashim, the place where the two cubits, roughly 4 to 6 feet wide, I assume on all four sides, and the door was 6 cubits, 9 to 10 feet across, and 10 cubits, 15 to 18 feet high. I think that that height because the outer walls of the temple itself were probably higher than the structures within the walls, and to keep curious eyes from the sight of Yah's kavod, and possibly incurring Yah's wrath. It was most holy, not just merely holy, but holy to the third power. Holy to the third power. I love that. Holy cubed, as it were. Avinu ben Ruach. Yep. Every possible way Yah manifests himself to humans. That's what they're doing right here in this temple. And that's what I got through verse 4.
Okay. Ken, if you want to comment, you've got just a minute or two. Go ahead and take us to the break.
Take us through the break.
I just want to make sure that we all understand things may be a little different in this tabernacle than they were in any other tabernacle. So let's
absolutely.
Let's not confuse them. Yeah. I mean, here it just seems to me like it's very open. It's very prepared for all of us. You know, the way I'm seeing it, it's most likely a place where we're all walking in and out in love, in oneness, you know, and in perfection. At least if you're inside of the inner court, you know, I would think that, you know, you've been judged to a certain point and you are now, you know, perfected enough to walk in and be with him. You know, you don't have to be separated anymore. Not as a completely clean human being, one who will never sin again, right? I mean, I think this is where we're living with him. Yet there may be others who are outside, yeah, that are maybe in the outer court. Maybe they can only come up to the altar in the inner court on occasion.
Time's up. Okay. On occasion, we got to go to break, so that's what we're going to do here, and we will be back.
And I pray, don't take me soon, because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know something, either I'll turn around because... Do 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 dum do be do dum dum. Come a come a dum do be do dum dum. Come a come a dum do be do dum dum. Keep the doors ajar. Do do. This is a lie.
All right, we are back, folks. Final segment today of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh edition and the book of Ezekiel into chapter 41 now. And more measurements of a new temple, and a temple that, again, that does not look like we have seen yet. Let's read the first few verses that follow the ones we've already talked about, verse 5 on. Next, it says, he measured the wall of the temple, 6 cubits. The width of each side chamber, all around the temple, was 4 cubits on every side. The side chambers were 3 stories, one above the other, 30 chambers in each story. And they rested on ledges, which were for the side chambers all around, that they might be supported, but not fastened to the wall of the temple. As one went up from story to story, the side chambers became wider all around because their supporting ledges in the wall temple ascended like steps. Therefore, the width of the structure increased as one went up from the lowest story to the highest by way of the middle one. So as you go up, it's literally like an inverted wedding cake, a pilot would like to say, because we're used to that structure. We see it in airspace, and we're going to see it in this temple here. I also saw an elevation all around the temple. It was the foundation of the side chambers, a full rod, that is, 6 cubits high. The thickness of the outer wall of the side chambers was 5 cubits, and also the remaining terrace by the place of the side chambers of the temple. And between it and the wall chambers was a width of 20 cubits all around the temple on every side. The doors of the side chamber are, they opened on the terrace, one door towards the north and another towards the south, and the width of the terrace all around was 5 cubits. Okay, well, let's pause there, and we'll go to MP this time. Mark? You guys hearing me?
He's unmuted. I'm here.
Okay. Were you not hearing me? Was there a problem?
No, I just see that Mark's mic is muted.
Okay.
So he just needs to unmute his mic.
That.
There it is.
How about now? Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. Here we go. Stones has a good comment on verses 5 and 6. Here's what it says. Along the wall, there were 3 levels of cells, one on top of the other, each level consisting of 11 cells, 5 on each on the north and south sides, and 1 on the west side. Okay, the nethermost chamber, this is still a Zamra now, was 5 cubits broad, and the middle was 6 cubits broad, and the third was 7 cubits broad. Now we're talking about going up in levels, okay? For without in the wall of the house, he made narrowed rests round about, and the beams should not be fastened in the walls of the house. And Azamra has a good comment as well in verses 5 through 11, which is like this. verses 5 through 11 describes the walls of the house and the dimensions of the side chambers that were built in banks around them, okay? 3 on the west side, 15 each on the north and south sides. Okay, now we're talking about 3 levels, 5 on each side and 1 in the middle. Okay, so on each level. Surrounding the sanctuary and the Holy of Holies are structures in the form of rooms or cells built one on top of the other. Everything that comes forth from the Holy of Holies divides into 3 columns. Thus, there are 3 rows of 5 cells along the south wall, 3 rows of 5 along the north wall, and 3 cells on top of one another along the west wall. Thus, the sanctuary is surrounded by cells on 3 sides. Let me explain the purpose of these cells. Besides the sustenance that the armies of angels received from the gates and the inner courtyard and beyond, they also receive air from behind the walls of the sanctuary itself. This is extra sustenance. Even though it comes to them from outside the sanctuary, it is on the highest level as opposed to the sustenance they receive from the gates, which is already on the lower level, even though it comes from inside. That all according to Ramchal. Again, now, this is me. Here, the angel brought Zeke to the outside, I think, of the house to describe for us the rest of the Kadoshiest of all. Okay, the Kadosh Kadoshim. The wall of the Kadoshiest, if I have this right, was 6 cubits high. Again, 6 cubits is roughly 8.5 to 9 feet. Unless Robert Earl Hughes was alive back then, no one was looking over the inner walls without stilts or a small helicopter. Now, I wonder how they built these cells, for lack of a better term, so they could stack them and have enough support for the upper two layers to rest on the narrower first layer. The details aren't here. On the other sides of the Kadoshius walls, on all sides except its east wall, the wall with entry from the inner courtyard where the animals were burnt on the altar, there were 11 chambers on the other three walls, 5 each on the north and southern sides, 1 on the western wall of the Kadoshius, okay? The east wall was open to the altar of burnt offering, the eastern gate of the temple, and I think the Mount of Olives across the Kidron Valley. There were a lot of 33 chambers, a total rather of 33 chambers in the walls of the Kadoshius in 3 levels. That, by the way, according to Rashi and also looking at the scripture. Now, the lowest levels chambers were 5 cubits broad. The middle level was 6 cubits broad. The top level was 7 cubits broad. These levels were literally stacked one layer upon the other, narrowest on the bottom, widest on the top. The easiest place that he might think that the walls might fall on him, as my assumption is that these had to be layered so that the lower stones would accept the weight of the stones above and not need any other support, either inside the holiest or outside. That's the builder in me talking, okay? And let's remember verse 7. The cells became broader, and there was a spiral for the cells preceding upward, so the temple was surrounded by successive levels all around the structure. Thus, the widest part of the structure was at the top level, and thus one would ascend from the lowest to the highest to the middle of the cells. Okay. What that describes to me is an ever-widening what?
No, we're just having artifacts today. Nasty internet connections. I don't think it was anything anybody said.
Okay. All right. Then here we go. This is the end of my commentary here through verse 7. What that describes to me is an ever-widening, spiraling opening so that the structure of this opening would look like the inside of a funnel. Okay? Stones Tanakh says this. There were 3 levels of cells, each wider than the one below, and a spiral staircase went from the lowest up to the highest. And that's exactly what was described in our scripture portion here in verses 5 through 7. I'm going to quit there and let somebody else talk.
Go ahead, Ken.
I'm done at verse 7.
I didn't read other commentary on this. Just because I can see how you could really read it in a number of different ways. But I will say that how it started in verse 5, that some of these chambers were on the side of the house, to me means on the outside of the house. So these chambers that you see in verse 6, to me, it just seems like these are on the outside of the house, but possibly up against the house itself. And that's roundabout, as in, if you look at pretty much all the drawings that I've seen of the temple, you have buildings or chambers to the south that were, you know, where the Levites were. You have chambers to the north, which is where the Zedekite priests were, and then you have a chamber to the west, you know, behind the temple itself. So you have like three areas roundabout, you know, and that might be what it's speaking of here, you know, in verses 5 through 6. Now, verse 7, it's what's for me. I couldn't help but have this imagery in my head of a spiral staircase, but only exactly. Instead of a staircase, it's of chambers. So, and to me, that just didn't quite make much sense as to where, you know, where this would be exactly and what it would really look like. So I would have to do some, I don't know, serious searching and finding out there in the world to come up with something that made sense to me on verse 7. That one was a tough one. but anyway, otherwise, it is very important, which I find interesting, that the thickness of the wall has been mentioned from the very beginning in chapter 40, and it's still being mentioned here. Of the chambers, I mean, yeah, chamber walls, temple wall, etc. And I'm hearing my own echo. I hope you guys are still hearing me.
Yeah, we are.
Are you guys still hearing me?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So, but anyway, so yeah, here, these side chambers again are mentioned, I believe, in verse 8 and on, but also, relate to the wall. You know, it mentions the thickness in verse 9 again. But these, chambers, I believe, are what they're talking about on the south and north sides of the house, which is for the chambers for the different priesthoods, Levitical and Zadokite priesthoods. It looks like quite the big structure. I guess that must be for their sleeping, their, you know, education, their eating, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's probably like a, you know, full living quarters in on both sides. Because I'm guessing these folks pretty much camp out and live in this area all the time. So those chambers would be used for both of the priesthoods. And I believe that might be why we have so many chambers on the outer wall, for example, for others, or like what was mentioned before, maybe for some storage because those outer chambers aren't so big. And when I say outer chambers, I'm speaking of the ones that are inside the outer wall, right? So the outer courtyard, on the outside of it is a outer wall, and you have chambers all the way around. I think there was like 5 chambers on either side of each gate. So there was a total of like 30 of these chambers. But these might be so small that they're mostly just used for storage. If they're any bigger, I would say they could be used for people, you know, for gatherings and such. Because I'm guessing this is likened to a city. You know, a very big space with a whole lot of people coming and going, you know. So we have to kind of think of it that way. Anyway, I think that's all I have through about verse 10 or 11. I'll go ahead and yield the mic.
Okay. Are we ready to continue? Do you got anything else you want to add first, Mark?
Yeah, I'll go through verse 10 or so here, and it won't take very long. The foundation stone buried in the ground was 6 cubits. That's 8 or 9 feet broad. I assume the top was level with the ground and only slightly above. Stone Snack has this comment on verse 9. We have read verses 9.
We've read through 11.
Verse 10, haven't we?
Correct.
We read through 11. Okay. Okay. Stone Snack has this comment on verse 9. Below ground level, the wall's foundation was 6 cubits, but it narrowed to 5 cubits above the ground. Stones also says that on verse 9, that the foundation of the cells was a full rod thick, which was 6 cubits. But that the stones were above the ground started at 5 cubits thick. I assume that the succeeding stones would have been slightly narrower at the height of the wall's rather as the height of the walls increased. I assume the outer wall was a pretty sheer rise with little to get a toehold on. I mean, if the craftsmen that we've become used to on this project contained with their continued rather with their superb attention to detail, there was little to get to hold on to scale these walls. And I assume that same care and attention to detail was used throughout the post, the most holy place in Jerusalem. Now, verse 10 tells us that there was an open space of 20 cubits around the house, meaning the Kodesh Kadeshim. So the western slaughter chambers that flanked and guarded the Kodesh Kadeshim were still 20 cubits from Yah's house, as it were. Yeah, that's what I got through verse 10.
Okay, so let's continue. Through 11, MP. Are you going to want to – anything you want to say on that before we continue on? All right, let's read on. The building that faced the separating courtyard at its western end was 70 cubits wide. The wall of the building was 5 cubits thick all around, and its length 90 cubits. So he measured the temple 100 cubits long, and the separating courtyard with its building and its walls was 100 cubits long. Also, the width of the eastern face of the temple, including the separating courtyard, was 100 cubits. So it's huge. He measured the length of the building behind it, facing the separating courtyard, with its galleries on one side and on the other side 100 cubits, as well as the inner temple and the porches of the court, their doorposts and the beveled window frames, and the galleries all around their three stories opposite the threshold were paneled with wood. From the ground to the windows were covered, and the space above the door, even to the inner room, as well as the outside and on every wall all around, inside and outside by measure. And it was made with cherubim and palm trees between cherub and cherub. Each cherub had two faces, so that the face of a man was toward a palm tree on one side, and the face of a young lion toward a palm tree on the other side. Thus it was made throughout the temple all around. And let's pause there. We've only got a few more verses.
Go to Ken. You still there, Mark?
I am. Yeah, Ken?
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah, you broke up for me, Kent, Mark. That's all.
Okay.
Yeah, it has been very broken lately. I'm not sure what's going on.
It's been the whole day. It's been bad at this end. So, we'll see what we can do later with the recording.
That will explain it.
So, like I was saying earlier, I've seen a lot of different renderings of this temple, this entire structure with the courtyards and chambers and the temple itself in the middle, and they're all a little bit different. And I'll tell you one thing that I can find in error on a lot of them is just from verse 13. It seems to me that the house itself is 100 cubits by 100 cubits, which means that it would be the same length as a inner wall. So I don't think there is a western inner wall. I think on the west side of the court, of the inner court, is nothing but the facade or the face of the tabernacle itself, because it says that it is 100 cubits long and wide. And that is the same measurement as the inner court. Yeah. So that would make sense that you would.
Wow. Just thought about that, Ken. You know, that is a really interesting thing. That is a really interesting thing. The measurements inside the courtyard are 100 cubits by 100 cubits, and the wall outside is 100 cubits by 100 cubits. That's just a little bit esoteric, isn't it?
I don't know what you mean.
I mean,
by
how
the
can
wall
they? How can they be the same and there still be a wall?
It's 100. What do you mean the wall is 100 cubit by 100 cubit?
this, we're talking about the temple proper, 100 cubits by 100 cubits. Okay? There's either not a wall, or the wall is paper thin. You know? Because the measurements are the same, inside and out.
Right, okay. Yeah, I think that that might be more generalized than, huh? You know?
just saying, but, you know.
Yeah.
Y'all can do that. We can't, but y'all can do that.
Yeah, but it does make sense that the one side, the west side, would be nothing but the building itself, you know?
Right.
And then you would have walls coming out from it, which would make the inner courtyard.
Here's what may be going on here. Okay? You got the inner court is, or the courtyard inside is 100 cubits wide. There is a, and you go around the outside and you measure it, and the outside is also 100 cubits by 100 cubits. Only Yah can do that. Okay? there's no way that we can even put our minds around that. All right? Unless we understand that the guy that made it is able to do whatever he wants to do. You know, he has no limitations whatsoever, even by our measurements. The wall is less than a millimeter thick.
Yeah, I don't think it talks about that wall, does it? I mean, in terms of what it's made of or what its dimensions are.
Exactly.
I mean, itself, not the length.
We got about less than a minute left.
Correct. Go ahead, and if there's anything you want to wrap up, then do that.
Right. So, yeah. So it says there on verse 14, the breadth of the face of the house. So that would be the face facing east. Toward the east, it says. So that would have to be the entire wall on the west side. That would be, instead of having a wall, you have a building. And that actually makes sense, because then you just have a southern wall with with gates in it. You'd have an eastern wall with gates in it, and you'd have a northern wall with gates in it. All of which bring you into the courtyard to the altar, but then if you immediately...
Okay, well, we are at the top of the hour break. That'll do it for today. We will finish chapter 41 and continue next week. Thanks, guys. Shalom.